Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week. Glad to finally see some spring-like temperatures around here in the city and further afield. It finally looks like the long winter is over, despite that snow shower last Friday. So I was in Florida this week at the American Conference of Irish Studies gathering, and it was a really interesting meeting of minds, and I heard some great papers. I had the pleasure of presenting on a panel with my colleagues, Dr. Marion Casey and Dr. Linda Dowling-Almeida, along with Professor Mary Hickman, who came all the way from London to join the panel as well. So there'll be more of that anon, as they say. Last night and again tonight, Mick Maloney, Jimmy Keane and Robbie O'Connell are holding a reunion concert at the Irish Arts Centre. We had Mick Maloney in there with us last week to have a chat about the return of these three friends making a triumphant return to New York City. Since 1984, the three of these guys have come together intermittently, and I'm sure last night was a great night, and tonight promises to be the same. So if you are in the New York area, I don't know if there are tickets still available, but go on the Irish Arts Centre website. Last week I played the song Kilkelly from that wonderful album of the same name, put together by Mick Maloney, Jimmy Keane and Robbie O'Connell. And I hope you won't mind indulging me, folks. I'm going to play it again a little bit later in the programme. It's a really, really beautiful and poignant song arranged by Peter Jones, I believe. And they do a great job of it, the three boys. And I'm just going to, as I say, indulge myself a little bit, and I hope you won't mind too much. It's a great emigrant song that speaks to the transatlantic links between Ireland and the United States and touches on so much of the social history of the period in question in the late 19th century, and really is a great example of that tradition of singing and lamenting and reflecting back on the homeland. So as a reminder, just for any of you who are interested, if you want to go on the website for the Irish Arts Centre and see if there is an odd ticket available, you may be in luck. Back to Glucksman Ireland House events. We had Theo Dorgan in during the week. Unfortunately, I missed him myself, and I'm quite disappointed about that because I've always wanted to meet Theo. I want to remind you that we have a very special event coming up on Thursday next. That's April 2nd, if you can believe it. We're into the month of April already and into the Easter season truly as well. Our visiting scholar, Professor Luke Gibbons, who comes to us by way of the National University of Ireland in Maynooth, his lecture is entitled Joyce's Ghosts. And Luke proposes that Joyce's Irishness is intrinsic to his modernism, and it is not just a source of subject matter, but of form itself. Luke will explore Joyce's stylistic innovations haunted by memory that slip its moorings in inner life and circulate through the silences and shadows of a colonial counter-public sphere. Luke is Professor of Irish Literary and Cultural Studies and author of several books. He's been visiting us since January, and it's really delightful to have his intellectual verve and energy around us here at Luxman Ireland House and in the Department of English here at NYU. So that's on Thursday, April 2nd at 7 p.m. folks. Do shoot us an email to ireland.house@nyu.edu if you are interested in attending that event. Luke always, always gives a great presentation. He knows his stuff and he's a wonderful delivery. So I would highly recommend for those of you who haven't yet had the pleasure of hearing him speak, don't miss out on this opportunity. While I'm talking about events the following week, just while we're at it, that's Thursday, April 9th, I'm delighted to announce that a well-known and renowned academic local person, Lucy McDiarmid, will launch her new book, Poets and the Peacock Dinner, The Literary History of a Meal. 100 years after W.B. Yeats, Ezra Pound and 5 other male poets gathered to eat a peacock, Lucy McDiarmid of Montclair State University explores the meal's far-reaching implications through literary history, biography and cultural theory. This book is just being launched, published by Oxford University Press. The volume will be launched by the poet Nuala Gonal, one of Ireland's foremost poets writing in the Irish language and a major influence in revitalising the language in modern poetry. So that event is coming up. We've had lots of interest in that event already. So do be in touch as soon as you can, because Lucy, she draws in a big audience, so do send us an email to ireland.house@nyu.edu if you're interested in that event or indeed in finding out more about what we do here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU. One of the pleasures we've had this semester has been to host the well-known and very accomplished and impressive writer Cullum Tobin here at Luxman Ireland House, NYU. He came in to talk to us and read from his new novel, Nora Webster, and I had the chance to sit down and have a chat to him about the book and the process of writing it, and indeed to talk a little bit about the filming of the movie based on his earlier book, Brooklyn. So I'm going to start off by sharing with you my interview with Cullum Tobin, and I'm going to segue right into the audio from his talk here with us in February. I thought it was about time I shared it with you all. So sit back and relax and enjoy Cullum speaking about Nora Webster. We'll then go to Kilkelly before I come back in to say goodbye to you all. So I hope you enjoy this, folks. I'm here at Luxman Ireland House. It's my pleasure to welcome Irish author based in New York, and I suppose between here and Ireland you go back and forth quite a lot. I'm here with Cullum Tobin. It's my pleasure, as someone who's not from, as the crow flies, too far from him in Ireland. Cullum, as many of you will know, is from Enniscorthy, and Enniscorthy is actually relevant to what we're going to talk about today, because we're going to discuss his newest novel and 8th book, Nora Webster, a novel. Welcome to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour, Cullum. Thank you for being here. Can I ask you something very basic, like what was the inspiration behind Nora Webster, or is it accumulation of things over years?
Well, some of it was personal, in that some of those things that happen in the book happened to me. Not all of them, so it's half of it's invented. But it is the story of what happened in our house after my father died. When my mother was there in her 40s, she was a widow, she had 2 sons living at home and 2 girls who were living elsewhere. So the novel is a dramatization of that. It took me years to do it because you have to put shape on that material. There's no point in just writing down what happened, because that would be really boring. You know, it wouldn't have any arc or shape. And I needed to find something for the book that would make it work for the reader and make it not merely my personal story that perhaps I could share with friends and family, but something that I could hand out to anyone and say, if you read this, you will get something that isn't merely my story, but is a bigger story than that. Although big is not the word, maybe, but maybe that just has a shape to it that might satisfy a reader.
So was there a particular moment? When did you begin actually really writing Nora Webster?
I wrote the first chapter in the spring of 2000, in the same season as I wrote the first chapter to the Henry James novel, The Master. And with both of them, then I just stopped. I just had the first chapters written. I thought, well, that was me. You know, sometimes you feel, God, that's a lot of work. I'd really love not to go on with either book. You just leave them there. But with the James book, I waited about 15 months, did nothing. And then I went and I actually did all the work on it. And so that came out 2004. But with Nora Webster, it just carried on. It just, every year I would get some scene and write it down. So really, by 3 or 4 years ago, I had more or less half the book written in scraps. And what I needed to do then was stitch the whole thing together. But I've been thinking about it all the time. And sometimes ideas came at night that seemed very good ones. And by the morning, they were gone. They were useless. The morning is a great time. You become very suspicious of everything, including yourself. And a great idea you had at night. So it was a lot of thinking things up, rejecting them, thinking new things, and trying to work out a way of telling the story and being faithful to it. You know, there are no car crashes. There's no big, you know, battles. It's all domestic and small. But you have to give something to you, to nourish that in some way as to make it interesting for the reader.
So, like, when you have those ideas at night, are you one of these people who has a pen and paper by the bed? No.
I mean, I always take the view that if anything is really worth remembering, you'd remember it. And the reason why we forget things is often a good reason. Mm-hmm. And a notebook is an awful nuisance because you write things down and then you think you don't have to remember them because they're written down. Mm-hmm. Whereas the whole point of not writing them down is that they then linger in your mind and they come to you again and they grow and something new happens to them. Whereas if they're written down, they're sort of stored away. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they're not dynamic in the sense of something that's in your memory mm-hmm. is dynamic.
It's interesting, Colm, you know, for someone like me who grew up in, I can relate very much to the Ireland you describe. I'm a little bit younger in terms of chronology, but it's an Ireland that I can relate to. But it's clear, you know, from the reviews and everything of the book that there's a universality that people who have no interest in Ireland or not familiar with it relate to. Can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the aim of any novel in a way, that you take material that you imagined or that it has some sort of meaning for you that's personal, and you put shape on it so when the reader gets it, it seems like a made thing, rather than being someone's blathering confessions, you know, something that they spewed out of themselves without putting any shape on it. You put shape on it and you give rhythm to it. And in doing those things, you actually then are making a thing in the same way as a carpenter is making a table. Mm-hmm. And someone can take the table home and forget how it was made. Mm-hmm. Or who made it, even. And so it will be the same with a novel.
In Nora Webster, place is, you know, very important. Is that something that you think about?
Yeah. That, in other words, the town of Enniscorthy is named in the book. And it's very clearly a topography that's real. You know, if you turn right there, you will see that shop, or you will even meet that person. And the scenes on the beach, you know, at Ballyconiger, all of that's absolutely real. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the business of, you know, that the sun rises over Vinegar Hill, you know, in the east. And so you can see how the day is going and the bridge. And, yeah, I couldn't really set it in a town I didn't know. Mm-hmm. That didn't have emotional meaning for me, but also that I didn't have some sort of serious knowledge of.
You spend a lot of time here in New York, but you spend a lot of time in Ireland, right? I mean, more generally, I suppose, like most people, you'd say that your sense of place or identity has evolved over time in terms of your travels and your writing and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think distance allows you to see certain things more clearly, but it may maim you in other ways, you know, being away a lot or all the time, that you don't really see what's actually going on in Ireland. And you might get a sense from the newspapers, but the sense would be wrong, you know. It's only really by living there you can get all that, but maybe I lived there enough.
So, to go back to that kind of question on the reaction of audiences, are there examples that spring to mind in terms of how, you know, an American audience or, you know, American readers as opposed to Irish readers, are there certain things that some people hone in on and others don't or whatever that you see?
Well, I think you have to be careful not to try and feel that you're explaining Ireland and that you're aware that your readers, most of your readers, will be non-Irish. For example, when you put in the figure like Charlie Haughey, who did dominate Irish politics over a period of, 20, 30 years. But if you put in a sort of an explanation of who he was, the reader has a right to feel, hold on a minute, who is this? You know, this guy is actually trying to find an international audience. Whereas I notice American writers don't have to do that when they talk about the White House. They don't have to say the White House, which was, you know, traditionally the place where the president lived. They don't have to do that because the world knows. But if you put in Áras an Uachtaráin, which is the house of the president in Ireland, or the Dáil, or the Taoiseach, or the Tánaiste, then you've got to be careful. You know, you don't have to explain. The readers can pick that up. Now, obviously, some people complain about this thing. You know, I couldn't work out who this, you know, so-and-so was, and all this Irish material. We say, well, actually, you know, every writer in every country does that. It's when you don't do it, when you do the explaining thing, you actually lose the rhythm and you lose the sort of faith with the reader. I think you write, if you're Irish, with an Irish reader in mind, and the world can listen in if it wants to. But if you decide to internationalize your voice and say, for example, use a term, for example, start using truck rather than lorry. Mm-hmm. Start using store rather than shop. I think you should be dragged away, really, and locked up.
Do people in Enniscorthy like the book?
You know, what happened in Enniscorthy is interesting, that the film of Brooklyn was made there. So for, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks or more, and the entire town was, you know, involved in some way or other. And the number of people who wanted to be extras was very high. And people got up in the morning. I think people were quite surprised at how hard everyone works in a film. Saoirse Ronan, who was the star of the movie, she was up at 6 in the morning, already ready for her day's work. Whereas, as you know, in an Irish town, people getting up at 9 would consider themselves busy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of good came into the town because of the book. And when the film opens, that would be even more so. People might think we should go, you know, we should go and look at this town.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, towns in Ireland need that now because a lot of towns have lost a lot of their economic base.
And was that important to you, Colm, that it would
be? I mean, I think, that, you know, we have a tradition in Ireland which, you know, Edna O'Brien had her book burned in her village in Clare, and John McGahan was fired from his job and his book banned. And I mean, I know Edna O'Brien and I knew John McGahan, and this wasn't, you know, a great thing to happen to you. I mean, it might have, people might have thought, oh, you know, you're becoming, you know, you're the rebel. But if you're a writer, you need quietness, you need a lot of peace. And having those sort of rows, public rows, are really not good for you. So, yeah, it's been good. You know, I wouldn't like it to be otherwise.
So I know we're moving off Nora Webster a little bit, but just because I know Brooklyn was really, got great reviews actually at Sundance Film Festival recently as well.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't go, unfortunately, but, you know, the thing is that it's a wonderful watching Saoirse Ronan in the film where she's moving from being this girl from a small town to being this quite sophisticated girl who's been in America. And it's just obviously something she knows, the difference between coming from a small town and coming back. And she does it wonderfully. There are scenes that would really, really make you smile where she's walking along the street in Enniscorthy, and it's 1952, and she's wearing sort of Lolita sunglasses. I mean, really glamorous sunglasses. She's got a suntan from Coney Island. She's got a yellow dress, and she's walking along with immense confidence. And just like 20 minutes or an hour earlier, she was this poor girl in town who couldn't find work, who has to go to America. And all the women at the town are looking at her, and it's really very enjoyable. You know, it's a very warm-hearted film.
So have you been very involved in the process?
You know, I don't know if you've read in the papers, but I certainly will be in the running for an Oscar because of my part in the film. I have a tiny role. I'm 1 second. If there's an Oscar for someone who appears in a film for 1 second, and I think there should be, I put a lot of work into it, then I have a 1 second role in the film where I'm an Irish immigrant and I'm trying to get through passport control and Saoirse Ronan is behind me. And we had to do about 20, I know, I'm exaggerating, about 10 takes on it. And I, you know, was expecting when I saw the film that I was going to be, you know, everyone was going to say, oh my God, you're wonderful, you know, you should be an actor. She was over in a second.
But how, as a writer, how do you feel about seeing, say, Brooklyn in film format?
I think what happens to you is that the emotion comes back to you, the initial emotion that caused you to write the book. And it comes back to you from the screen. and it's very powerful.
That whole idea of the relationship between this, that what we might call Irish literature, that strange dotted line that goes from the poem or from the mythology to the present, where it's only in recent years that that dotted line has become almost more interesting than a lot of very clear lines. There's an essay by Seamus Heaney, it's an introduction to the selected essays of Thomas Flanagan, which is published by the New York Review of Books. And in that essay, Heaney's extremely interesting about going to Berkeley, even in the late 1960s, after his first book had come out, and teaching for a year, and having Thomas Flanagan there with him, who had written, I mean, I think it's a pioneering book, it was a PhD thesis under Lionel Trilling at Columbia, which became a book called The Irish Novelists. And we think, well, the Irish novelists have to be Joyce and Beckett, but he dealt with the Irish novelists before that. He dealt with William Carleton, John Bannum, Somerville and Ross, and poor old Lady Morgan. And he was talking about the Irish novel before Joyce, and talking about the ways in which these novelists were actually no use to Joyce, that Joyce had to begin from scratch, because these figures had left him almost no legacy, and that each of them, in their own way, had produced something chaotic, untidy, and strange. But actually, in recent years, what's chaotic, tidy, and strange has become very interesting, especially in universities. And the idea then of trying to establish an Irish canon, and especially trying to do so in various universities, and has been, I suppose, the project over the last 20 years. Certainly there were times, and Greg will be aware of this, and where we were teaching something in Princeton, in the realization that this is the first time the words William Carleton have been said in this institution in its long and distinguished history. That somehow or other, doing some of these seminars was actually breaking glass. I remember my first year in Columbia, where somebody, one of the students very politely said, "Professor, you know, we're a bit puzzled about this Jonathan Swift being Irish, because we did him last year." And I said, "Well, there was no mention of him being Irish." And I said, "Well, you know, he did live most of his life in Ireland. He wrote a great deal. You know, he wrote A Modest Proposal. It wasn't written about English babies. It's about Irish babies have to be eaten. You know, and he wrote, etc. You know, as a pamphleteer. But you know, so that you know, things are sort of going to change. There was another moment, it was in Princeton, where I was on my way to give a lecture on Edmund Spencer, and I met a serious, serious Spencer scholar coming towards me, and just by accident, you know, he said to me, what are you going to do? I said, "I know, I'm giving this lecture on Spencer." He said, you are giving a lecture on Spencer? I said, "Yeah, you know, Spencer in Ireland." "It's Spencer? And Edmund Spencer in Ireland?" I said, "Yeah, you know, he wrote The Faerie Queen in Ireland. He wrote a book called Review of the Present State of Ireland." I said, I never really thought about that. And there's a tremendous fun you can have in The Faerie Queen. There's a wonderful moment where, it's in the seventh book, where he has, at the end of a line, he has the word file, F-I-L-E. He needs it because he needs a rhyme with style. You look at the word, you realize that the line makes no sense. The footnote in the scholarly edition is no help at all. It's completely wrong. There's only one way you can read the word file. And once you read it that way, it becomes absolutely clear. It's not file, although it's pronounced file within the rhyming scheme. It's, of course, filler, F-I-L-E. And once you read it as filler, then the stanza makes absolute sense. And so I had a lot of fun with this because I was telling everyone, you know, Spencer, he had Irish. this is really just a way of saying that what Glucksman Ireland House has done is to establish a place where this tradition, this strange dotted line, it can be studied seriously and can actually, Heaney talks in that essay. You see, he has studied English at Queen's University, where all his professors were English, and they all come from English universities. And therefore, there was no such thing as Irish literature. It wasn't merely that Spencer was English. I mean, there is a great case to be made, by the way, for Spencer being English, or Jonathan Swift being an Augustan and being English. But actually that the only Irish writers worthy of study were Joyce and Yeats. That before that, there was almost nothing. And indeed, after that, nothing too. So that figures like Maria Edgeworth and William Carleton, and indeed figures who came later, such as Patrick Kavanagh, were simply not part of any canon. So that it was only when Healy went to Berkeley and began to work with Thomas Flanagan that he realised something about his own country that, of course, helped him enormously as a poet. And in Station Island, he evokes the presence of William Carleton in his own imagination, and William Carleton on his way to Lough Derg. So that whole idea of how we view the tradition of Irish literature, I think actually nourishes and changes the way actually literature is written in Ireland. In other words, to look at, say, the comic tradition from the mythology or the poem onwards, I think might help a comic novelist working now. And then, as Greg has pointed out, if you're just, I think tears is a bit strong. I think the book just makes people sad. But if you're trying to write in that sort of tradition of sadness, you know, you actually need to know about George Moore. You need to know, you know, about some aspect of William Carleton, and probably even to go further back as well. Anyway, so I just want to start with that, and I want to say also that I'm not sure, I really wish, maybe up in Cornell, if you could help me with this, you're also smart up there, I'm not sure when it became possible for novelists to actually put themselves into a novel and to more or less say that while this is a novel and some of it is made up, that most of it is true, and it is some way of examining that I could allow myself to actually look at things that happen and try and put shape on them. I've been reading Sybil Bedford's book, A Legacy, which it's set actually in the Germany before the First World War, but you slowly realise when you look at her dates that the little girl born in 1911 in that book is the author of the book, and that the mother, Caroline, is her mother. And that father, that old rake of a man, is her father. And that what she's doing is she's recreating, re-establishing, reinventing her own background and the generation before her own so that she can somehow make sense of herself. And it's something that emerges slowly in the book. It emerges also in Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, which he published when he was 25, and which deals with his family in Lübeck and the death of his father, but also how the family built up their business. And he himself, instead of becoming a novelist in the book, he becomes a musician. And he gives himself the great satisfaction of killing himself off. In other words, instead of becoming Thomas Mann adult, he dies this very melancholy death in Buddenbrooks. But so that there is a tradition which would go into Ireland in the case of something like Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, or later on, when I got to know the novelist John McGahern, I would realise more and more. I mean, we were sitting up late at night, and I'd say, but John, and he'd say, I know, meaning that was in the book. You know, it was a whole story he'd been telling. I said, but John, that's in the book. He said, oh, I know. And this first episode, it's in the book. there's nothing much to say about it. It's set at Scorthy, County Wexford in the southeast of Ireland. It's probably 1968, there's a mention later on of Jim and Margaret, who are Nora's very conservative brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and the mention of the boys, who are her two sons, who are Donal and Connor, who are also mentioned, and there's a mention of dinner. I should say that dinner in this particular town, at this particular time, happens in the middle of the day. And the idea of having dinner in the evening would have been the most shocking waste of time. You should be doing your homework. Anyway, so that's when dinner is. On Wednesday morning, she went downtown and had her hair done, talking to Bernie and the hairdressers about a new system of dyeing hair she'd read about, wondering if it was time that she did something about the grey. I wouldn't like it blue, she said. I know what you mean, Bernie replied. And if it was too black, then it would look dyed. And I was never blonde. Everyone in town knows I was never blonde. Is that a good brown, so that it might not look dyed? I could try this one. Bernie showed her a package with a photograph of a woman with curly brown hair that looked natural. Maybe just start off with a small bit, she said. No, the instructions say to use the whole thing, Bernie said. I've used it before. It's very popular. You would be surprised who has it. Well, try it so, Nora said. Once the dye had been applied, Bernie put a nylon net on her head and left her to flick through some magazines. When she saw that she would not be home in time to cook a proper dinner for the boys, she regretted having come here at all and knew that she would have to go soon. She signalled to Bernie, who was now busy with two women who had come in together and appeared to need to consult each other about each click of the scissors. I'll be right with you, Bernie said. When she came over to remove the net, Bernie told her not to worry or look too closely, as the real change would come only once the dryer and the brush and comb were used. Nor was aware that the two women Bernie had been looking after were studying her closely. Nora wondered if she should not have consulted other women about getting her hair dyed for the first time, but she couldn't think of anyone she could have asked. Both of her sisters, she presumed, dyed their hair, but she'd never heard them talking about it. Slowly, as she watched Bernie working with the hairdryer, she realized that she had been given the hairstyle of a much younger woman, and that the women watching it all happen knew that and were taking it in with considerable satisfaction. The more Bernie worked, the more her hair seemed to look like a wig. She knew that the dye would take time to wash out, but in the mirror she could see how pleased Bernie was with her own work. There would be no point in complaining. It's not a bit young for me, she asked. I think you look great, Bernie replied, but the cut is very fashionable at the moment. Well, I've never had a fashionable cut before, Nora said. When it was finished, she knew that anyone who saw her on the way home would think that she had lost her mind, or that she was trying to look like a young woman rather than someone who was recently widowed. It'll take a few days to get used to, Bernie said, but no one has grey hair anymore. Does the dye not look very unnatural? In a few days, it will lose that look, and people will think you've had it all your life, but you look very worried, but I promise you that by the weekend you'll be delighted with it. You can't wash it out, can you? No, but it will fade, and I guarantee that you'll be back here in a month for the same again. I've never known anyone to go back to the grey. But maybe the next time we'll think of putting some highlights in. They're all the rage now as well. Highlights? I don't think so. Outside, she lifted her head high and hoped that all the women in Court Street and John Street would be busy cooking and that none of them would be standing at the door. She prayed that she would meet no one she knew. In her mind, she went through the worst possible encounters, the people who would most deplore the idea that with her husband 6 months in the grave, she had dyed her hair a colour it had never been before. She thought of Jim, her brother-in-law, and knew that if she would have to face him and Margaret within a week, they would not know what to think. As she saw Mrs. Hogan from John Street walking towards her, Nora could not tell whether Mrs. Hogan simply did not recognise her or if she wanted to get by her without making any comment. Just as Mrs. Hogan approached her, she seemed almost to jump. Her face quivered and then she stopped. Well, that will take some getting used to, she said. Nora tried to smile. Was it burning? Mrs. Hogan asked. Nora nodded. I heard she got some new packets in all right. God, I must go to her myself. If Mrs. Hogan, in her apron and a pair of very worn-looking shoes, felt that she'd right to comment on Nora's hair, then there was, Nora felt, no reason why she could not comment in reply. Well, you know where she is, she said dryly, looking at Mrs. Hogan's hair, clearly suggesting that it could benefit from some treatment. It took Mrs. Hogan a moment to take in the possibility that she was being insulted. Quickly, when she arrived home, she boiled some potatoes and opened a tin of peas and put 3 lamb chops on the pan. When the boys arrived, the potatoes were not ready. She waited upstairs, calling down to let them know that their dinner would be a bit late. She sat in front of the mirror at the dressing table and tried to work out if there was anything she could do to her hair to make it look more normal. She wished she had told Bernie not to use the lacquer, which was sticky and had a sweet smell. As soon as the boys saw her, they both became quiet. Donham looked away while Connor moved towards her. He reached up and touched her hair. "It's all hard," he said. "Where did you get it?" I had my hair done this morning," she said. "Do you like it?" "What under there?" "Under what?" "Under what you have on your head." "What I have on my head is my hair." "Are you going to go out with that?" he asked. Donald glanced at her again and looked away. Anyway, the painter Tony O'Malley lived in Enniscorthy in the 1940s, and he worked in a bank, and he did a lot of work around the town. I mean, he would go out at the weekends and he would make drawings or watercolors of the landscape and parts of the town. He came back. He eventually went to St. Ives in Cornwall, and he became a member of that group of artists, including Peter Lanyon and Barbara Hepworth in St. Ives. And eventually he came back to Ireland for a retrospective, and then he came back to live eventually, but at first came back because it was a touring retrospective of his work, and it came pretty close to Enniscorthy, so he thought he should go back to Enniscorthy. It was almost 40 years since he'd been in the town, but it being Enniscorthy, everyone of course remembered him and recognised him. So he walked through the town, he met loads of people, and my mother and my aunt had both known him, and it was a lot of talk about Tony O'Malley at that time. But one of the things that happened, which he told me himself, was that this woman came up to him. It was a woman called Pidge Hayes, and he had stayed in their boarding house when he was a bank clerk almost 40 years earlier. And they talked about various things, and just as she was going, she said, "Tony, by the way, there's that suitcase you left. You know, that's still there. Anytime you want to take that, then that's fine with us." So as he was going, he went to the house. What could possibly be in a suitcase? But the suitcase was full to the top with drawings and gouaches and watercolours. And the work that he thought he had lost along the way, and his wife Jane, you know, always knew that there was a big chunk of work missing. There it all was. And the strange thing about it is that it's almost topographical. You know, even though he's using full colours, nonetheless, you can if you know the landscape or the town, you can see where he was working. And he writes the name of the place at the bottom and everything. But there's one place you wouldn't know, which is he did a lot of work in Ballyconiger, which is the strand or the beach from the village of Blackwater. And he did drawings and he did watercolours of the hill behind a house called Keating's. The problem is, of course, that hill is not there anymore. That has been taken away by the erosion. And there was a watchtower at the top of it. And I mean, I remember it vividly. It was there till the 1970s. And slowly, slowly, it was eaten. So there's no sign of it now. I have a postcard of that landscape. But even people didn't think of photographing it much. There's almost no evidence that it ever existed. So you would think that Tony O'Malley must have made up that hill. So that this landscape is a landscape that some of my novels are also set in besides Enniscorthy. It could start at a place called Ballyconiger Upper, which is also called Cush or Cush Gap. And that's really eroding. People have a funny way of talking. They tend not to, if there's anything difficult to be said, people will tend not to say it. They'll find euphemisms for almost everything. So when my cousin, my father's first cousin, when his house was about to fall over, it did fall over, and houses are falling over all the time, but people don't like using falling over or erosion. They would just say about somebody, he went into the village. Meaning that since he had no house on the, you know, he had to go somewhere. And of course the first point of call would be the village. But they would say it in a sort of a pointed but sad sort of way. And they'd look at you to make clear that, you know, there was something else they were trying to say. I didn't want to say because it was too hard. And I don't know. Because I was asking about a family because the house had come very close, or the cliff had come very close to it. And someone said, No. You see, they did Christmas there, but once January came, they went into the village. Anyway, if you go south from there, you end up in a place which is called Keatings, and it's also called Ballyconiger Lower. And there's a wonderful thing there. There's a river that changes its course every year, and which was always very exciting. And then if you go further along, going south, you're going towards Rosslare. You can see Rosslare. You can see a place called Ballyvaloo, which still has a convent for the Sisters of St. John of God. And it was very exciting when we were growing up there because you'd see nuns. And this was, I don't know, Vatican II had no effect on the nuns anyway because they were in their full regalia. And you'd be on the strand, and it'd be a beautiful summer's day, you'd say, Mammy, look, there's a nun! And there could be two nuns, and they'd look like whales or octopuses or something that had come in from the deep. You know, their full black regalia. I suppose they were praying, and they were walking along praying. Anyway, it was just a memory from that time. And then if you go further along, you reach Kirklow, where the beach or the strand gets much longer with sand dunes. It's very like a beach in Normandy, which is why they filmed Saving Private Ryan, the beach scenes on that particular beach. But anyway, what's happened is that Nora has got a job, and she's been bullied at work by a woman who hates her for pretty good reasons, actually, and has ended up having a fight with the woman about 11 o'clock in the morning. She almost stabs her with a pair of scissors, but doesn't, and goes outside, and she's in an old car, and realizes she's walked out of work, and she's got scissors in her hand on the street, and then she decides to get into the car, and she decides to go to this place, the village is Blackwater, and then go on to Ballyconiger from there, just because she's nowhere else to go. And she stopped in Blackwater and bought a packet of 10 Carol cigarettes and a box of matches. She had not smoked for years and promised herself that she would not smoke all of these cigarettes either, just two or three before throwing the packet away. When she inhaled, she felt dizzy, and that made her remember how tired she was. She'd been suffering from insomnia before this, so it's clear that she's really, really tired. She threw the cigarette out the window, then put her head back and fell asleep. When she woke, she spotted a woman standing on the bridge looking over at her car. As the woman approached, she started the engine. So she drives to Ballyconiger. She had not expected to find a haze over the water. She sat in the car in front of Keating's house and looked down in the direction of Rosslare, taking in the heavy milky light that lay over the strand going towards Kirklow and Raven Point. When she got out of the car, she felt how unusually close and humid it was, as if there was thunder coming. She put on a pair of flat shoes that she kept in the car. There were no other cars in the car park. She walked carefully on the stony stretch between the grass and the river, and crossed a small wooden bridge and made her way south. In all the years, she thought, she'd never come here even as late in the season as October. She imagined now how strange it would be in December and January, how storm-swept and wintry and how biting the cold. There was hardly any colour. The world in front of her had been washed down. If she moved nearer the shore, she could look at the small stones that made a rattling sound when the waves broke over them. She saw how exact each colour of each stone was, and it allowed her to forget work and to stop worrying about what she would do. She could barely see ahead of her as she walked. It might have been easy to imagine that this was a place that belonged more to Morris than to her. Morris is her husband, who's dead about 6 months or a bit longer. It was the world filled with absences. There was merely the hushed sound of the water and stray cries of seabirds flying close to the surface of the calm sea. She could make out the sun as it glowed through the curtain of haze. It was unlikely that Morris was anywhere except buried in the graveyard where she'd left him. But nonetheless, the idea lingered that if he or his spirit were anywhere in the world, then he would be here. She thought it almost natural that if his spirit were on this stretch of strand, he would have his own concerns, the details of her life, her job, or what might happen in the future with the children. These would be matters that would seem as vague to him as the far distance did now to her, things that would pass as his life had passed. What had happened in the days before his death, the blockage in his system that caused him to cry out so his voice could be heard through the hospital, that would be with him now more than anything else. It came to her again, his death. She pictured those who were there, Jim and Margaret, his brother and sister, and Sister Thomas from the convent of St. John of God, who'd said special prayers, and then old Father Quaid. For the last 2 days, Nora herself had stayed by his bedside, but he was already far away from them. So far that they might have been like shadows, people already lost to him. Maybe he could only imagine them all as vague presences, the ones he had loved, but love hardly mattered then, just as the haze here now meant that the line between things hardly mattered. As she reached Ballyvaloo, and the luminous grey whiteness was moved down the strand by the mild wind towards Carricklow, she saw that there was a single nun walking back towards the lane that led to the retreat house of the Sisters of St. John of God. Wearing a full black habit, she walked slowly and with a difficulty. Nora thought that she must be one of the retired nuns who often came here on holiday or on retreat. When she was closer, she saw that the nun was Sister Thomas. Nora was surprised she was in Ballyvaloo. She had not known that she ever spent time away from her own convent and the town. She moved towards her, and when she reached her, Sister Thomas greeted her, put out her hands and took both of Nora's hands and held them. Suddenly, Nora felt cold and began to shiver. She could hear wind blowing, so almost whistling in the distance. But when she looked out at the sea and down the strand, it all seemed calm. There was no sign of the haze lifting. "You shouldn't be here on your own," Sister Thomas said. "I was in Blackwater this morning to see a friend, and just a while ago she saw you fast asleep in the car, and then driving towards the strand, and she phoned me in the convent because she was worried and wanted to know what she should do. So I walked down here in case I would find you. Who saw me? I thought I would come down to the shoreline to see if you were here," Sister Thomas said quietly. "I don't often leave the retreat house. Today it's more like heaven than earth down here." "I saw her all right," Nora said. "Someone who can't mind her own business." "That is one way of putting it," Sister Thomas said. "Someone who's looking out for you." Sister Thomas released Nora's hands. "I was not surprised to see you down here," she said. "It was meant to happen, us meeting like this. This is how the Lord works." "Don't tell me how the Lord works," Nora said. Don't tell me that again." "When Morris was dying," Sister Thomas said, "I asked the Lord to make it easy for him and for you. I have no needs of my own, and I have not asked him for anything in a long time, but I asked him for that, and he denied me what I asked. There must have been a reason for saying no, and the reason is hidden from us. But I know that he is watching over you, and maybe that is why we met, so I could tell you that." "He has not been watching over me," Nora said. "No one has been watching over me. I knew when I woke today and said my prayers this morning," Sister Thomas said, "that I was to see you." Nora was silent. "So turn back now before the fog comes down so hard that you won't be able to drive home," Sister Thomas said. "Go home. The boys will be home soon. The boys will be home from school waiting for you." "I can't work in that job anymore," Nora said. "She shouted at me. She said things today that made it impossible for me to stay." "It will be all right," Sister Thomas said. "It is a small town, and it will guard you. Go back to it now and stop grieving, Nora. The time for that is over. Do you hear me?" "I felt as I walked down here," Nora began. "We all feel that on days like this," Sister Thomas interrupted, "and even on other days. It is why we come here. Those who have passed on have it for shelter on their way elsewhere. It is nice to be among them on a day like this." "Among them? What do you mean?" "We walk among them sometimes, the ones who've left us. They're filled with something that none of us knows yet. It is a mystery. She held Nora's two hands again and then released them and turned and walked slowly, as though in pain, back towards the dunes and the lane leading to the retreat house. Nora waited to see if she would look back, but she did not. So Nora stood for a while without moving, looking out at the sea still covered in haze. And then she began to make her way along the strand towards where she'd left the car. Miss Kavanagh's large, big scissors were on the front passenger seat beside the packet of cigarettes. She put the cigarettes in the glove compartment, but took the scissors out of the car and left them down on the gravel for someone else to find.
My dear and loving son John, your good friend, the schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England. The house is so empty and sad. Crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad and be sure to come on home soon. Kelly, Ireland, 1870, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael's got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose, that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy, you named a child for her, although she's got six of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind, or when you'll be coming home. Sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. Don't have to worry, she died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good to hear that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can.
Okay.
that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out my home. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. Thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1892. My dear brother John, I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she says he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. Ah, you should have seen him playing with the grandchildren at McNamara. And we buried him alongside of Mother down at Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so hard. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you again.
We are coming towards the end of the programme. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on nyuirish.net/radiohour, and at irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer Jamie Sweeney, our email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to us on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend, folks. Slán agus beannacht.